You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow, Brandon
Sanderson, Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Greg Iles.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories, bringing you the very best author interviews from the best writers writing today. I'd like to thank some sponsors today that make the show possible. Patricia Gillum, A Superhero's Duty, a fight between a second-generation superhero named Red Bolt and a villain-for-hire named Icarus goes terribly wrong, resulting in the drowning deaths of three innocent civilians and orphaning a six-year-old boy. Racked with guilt, Red Bolt visits Cameron Wilson at the hospital every night and won't leave the boy's side until he falls asleep. Befriended by a night shift nurse, the man in costume begins to disclose what really happened after the fight and why he feels the deaths of Cameron's parents and sister fall on his actions. A superhero didn't survive that night, and Cameron and the rest of the city aren't out of danger. A Superhero's Duty by Patricia Gillum. There's a link to it in the show notes. I'd also like to tell you about my friend Crystal Pico Watanabe of Pico's House. The Pico's House website now has a new look. Visit Crystal and her team of eight people who help her provide services to fiction authors. Crystal's full slate of services now include beta reading, manuscript critique, developmental editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Authors, you can also inquire about putting your books in her Book Lovers Box, which is a monthly digital subscription box with a different theme each month. This is free for authors for a limited time. PicosHouse.com for all your book publishing needs. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited to have Greg Iles on the show with me today. Greg has been a literary hero of mine for quite some time, a fellow Mississippian and the writer of fantastic books. Happy to have you here today, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Hank. Looking forward to it.
Greg, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Wow. You start with the big one, don't you?
That's right. We go straight for the juggler.
You know, here's the thing. I don't really have a memory like that. Writing was just something that, as I went through my very young life, on through school, that people just told me I could do or that I was had a gift for, okay? I was just into reading, okay? I didn't imagine even that there were guys sitting in a room somewhere writing these things like The Count of Monte Cristo that just took me to some other place, you know? And so the idea that I could become one of those guys, yeah, that didn't really hit until much later. And even then, when you grew up in Mississippi, man, the last person who, you know, had really made a life of that I knew about was William Faulkner.
Right.
And how do you draw a line that, you know, from where you are to say, yeah, I'm going to be William Faulkner? You can't, you know, you're raised to be a doctor, a lawyer, a engineer or whatever, you know, or they hope you are. So, but there just came a time, you know, my first job after college and during college was a musician, you know.
Right.
I was an artist. That's an equally crazy profession to pick, but at least you can make a living, you know, and you're in and around your state and region by playing music. And that doesn't exist for writers, you know. There's no sort of farm league for writers, as you know. You're either unpublished or you're published. Now, there are a lot of published writers who are not really making a living and have to keep their regular job, so I guess you could consider that sort of the farm league. You know, when I was starting out, I met women who, you know, wrote one romance novel every 2 months and paid their house note and insurance and stuff, you know. But I'm giving you a long answer there. Sorry about that.
That's the answer.
So, yeah. So, anyway, you know, when I got to college, I realized, you know, this is something I would like to do, but I pursued music instead. And then when I was about 29, man, I made $30,000 that year, I think, or somewhere around that, and I was on tour for 50 weeks a year, and I realized, man, this is no way to this is no way to live, you know, this is not going to work. And I had just gotten married, and so I just stopped, and I gave myself 1 year to write a best-selling novel, as crazy as that sounds, and I managed to do it, which is just seems crazy looking back. But
I've heard a similar story to that from a couple of different people. There's something about that personal challenge. I'm going to give myself a year to do this. I'm going to dip into my savings. I'm going to do whatever. And then once that year is over, I'm going to just, you know, close the chapter. I'm going to go on to do something else. And, you know, I've heard that story turn out well more times than not. Do you think that there's something psychological about just that do or die, this is my last shot, I'm going to do it, or I'm not?
I think there's something magical about it if it is your last shot.
Mm.
Okay. If you just, like, I know a guy who, one of the smartest guys I know, I don't want to give too many details, and he's successful now, but not as a writer. And he had grown up wanting to be a writer from the start, and he had the brains to do it, certainly. And after college, I won't say where, but he went to this idyllic house on a beach and sat there every day. And he gave himself a certain amount of time. You know, it may have been a year, it may have been 6 months. And at the end of it, he realized that there was nothing there. He didn't have it, you know. So that was not a happy ending. And he probably didn't give himself a fair shot. I mean, who among us at 23 is ready to do that?
Right.
But I think you're right to say that if you have a gift and you are in that situation and you just say, by God, I'm locking the door and I'm giving it 100%. Till I beat this thing into submission. there's a lot to be said for doing that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. One thing I'm really fascinated by and I'd love to talk about is the intersection between different artistic expressions and how they tend to inform one another, or they tend to, I don't know if it's some wiring that happens in our brain that if we pursue one, it tends to inform the other, or make the other stronger. Do you ever feel like your time as a musician has informed your writing, has made you a better writer, or has equipped you in some way, to be a better storyteller?
100%. And the primary reason is, rhythm. You know, language has a rhythm.
Yeah.
And I've had this sort of quarrel with editors. If you get an editor that's sort of tone deaf or something, they'll make a suggestion or something, and you think, how could they possibly suggest this? Don't they see the rhythm of what's there, you know, and that
right.
The change is going to interfere with that? And the quickest way to find that out, and I wish I had the luxury to do this with more of my book than I do, and that is to read it aloud. I've got a guy, the editor who discovered me on my very first book, Spandau Phoenix, and he gave me my first deal. He and I just talk on the phone now. And now and then when we come to really important parts, or I'm an important part of the book, or, you know, I don't get the chance that much. I write under such time pressure, but now and then I get to put in a piece of what I call lapidary prose, you know, where it's really just trying to get it right. And we'll just find ourselves reading aloud back and forth on the phone. And the second you start to read aloud, choices about words, subtle meanings, whatever, instantly become apparent when you do that. And I think that began with music and songwriting and just unconsciously studying songs, the concise nature of songwriting. People like Paul Simon, you know, who just have done, or even John Prine, you know, people who people who've communicated very complex and moving things in three verses. You
exactly.
know, you're blown away by it, and you can't. You realize, man, I'll never measure up to this, you know, but you try.
If you can rip somebody's heart out in 3.5 minutes, then you've got it.
Man, you take a song like Angel from Montgomery, John Prine.
Yeah.
Man, what novel ever ripped your heart out like that song?
Exactly.
Or you know what? Like, one of my favorite things Stephen King ever did, it was the story The Body, which became the movie Stand By Me.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Great, great movie. And that nostalgia contained in there is so poignant. And you take the John Prine song Paradise about growing up in the coal mining country down the river, you know, Daddy wants to take me back to Muhlenberg County, you know, where the air smelled like snakes and we'd shoot with our pistols, but empty pop bottles was all we would kill. I mean, you know, there it is, man.
Yeah, and there's a whole generation of songwriters coming up now that John Prine informed and are carrying on that tradition. I think of Jason Isbell, especially, that can just... I mean, he slays me, and then and you can go back and you can see that Prine influence, and there's it's just amazing stuff that he does.
Well, let me tell you, I hadn't really discovered Isbell yet. Everybody's telling me about him. I'm friends with Mac McAnally.
Oh yeah,
I was just over in Muscle Shoals, and I think Jason recorded something over there. So I'm going to start listening
from
to
there.
The songs.
Yeah, he's from
there originally.
Yep.
Okay,
yep. Get his album Southeastern, and I dare you. To have a dry eye at the end. I dare you.
Okay. All right. I'll check it out.
All right. So now that we've established that, you talked about, the rhythm and kind of the cadence, of writing. And, you know, a writer's voice is one of those things that we talk about, and you can't exactly put your finger on what defines a writer's voice. On a micro level, when you're talking about the rhythm of prose, do you ever stand back and look at the page, just the physical view of the page, and tell if, especially if it's dialogue, tell if the passage is doing what you want it to do? Is there a visual aspect, talking about rhythm that comes across in writing?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I would say that I don't normally do that, and I think the reason I don't is because working in the realm of the word processor, pagination is so fluid, you know? And of course, yeah, you can look at a dialogue scene much in the way you look at a screenplay, and you get a certain level of feel about it. Now, this is getting into subtle, crafty things, but I mean, I imagine your eye and your brain is making a judgment just to sort of the relationship between space and text, you know?
Right.
How much space, how much text, how much conciseness do you have? You think about some of those great old Hollywood screenwriters, man, where it was just pa-pow, 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 you know, all through there. And there are times when I try to get that. You wouldn't think so in long books, but I will say, even though I write long, I think the only way that I've managed to succeed is by giving people the sense while they're reading it that it's not long, that they're moving through it very fast.
Yes. Yeah.
Otherwise, there'd be no way to get them to read a 800-page book, you know?
Right, right. And I mean, no, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Larry McMurtry, man, the gold standard of a long book, man. Lonesome Dove, come on. It's like you pray that book would never end, you know?
Yeah. And there's things about dialogue, you know, sometimes you get that rapid fire back and forth. And then sometimes you get, like B.B. King talks about, the spaces between the notes and sometimes the most powerful thing is what's not said or what's alluded to and letting the reader kind of, breathe with it for a little bit.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. God, I'm listening to you say that. And I thought about McMurtry and I think about Robert Duvall playing Gus, and just lines. I mean, you talk about John Prine level lines, like, "By God, Woodrow, it ain't dying I'm talking about; it's living." You know, just or like Stephen King, "Get busy living or get busy dying."
That's
there
right.
There it is, man.
There it is. That's powerful stuff. Would you you gave yourself that time to figure it out, to be a writer and put yourself under self-imposed deadline, and Spandau Phoenix came out of that, right?
Yes, it did.
That Spandau Phoenix, I love that book. It's absolutely amazing. It is very different from probably what a lot of people discovered you for now, and you know, the Natchez Burning trilogy. What was the initial idea for Spandau, and have you always been a thriller guy and that kind of big stage
type story? I'm gonna tell you the real truth, Hank, is that I told you, you know, I was at a point in my career I didn't really have any money. You know, I was gonna try to transition and become a writer, and in music, I had made a cardinal mistake, and that is that I had got caught up in playing other people's music to make the highest money that I could playing music to survive, rather than just going, you know what, I'm going to drop everything, move to Los Angeles, and do nothing but write songs, okay? So when I made the switch to writing books, I said, I'm not messing around here, okay? I've got to write something that will sell in the heart of the publishing industry, and that's New York City, and I've got to stand out from everything else. And so I very consciously said, I've got to write a best-selling novel. And around that time, we were still in the day of, you know, Jack Higgins, and I guess Tom Clancy had come out, yeah, and stuff like that. And so I just said, got Frederick Forsyth had written some great stuff. Ken Follett, you know, all those guys had done World War II books. And I was born in Germany. I knew a lot about it. My dad had served over there. And so one night, believe it or not, I was watching 60 Minutes, and I saw a feature on Rudolf Hess being the last surviving Nazi prisoner of Spandau Phoenix. And there was this unsolved mystery about it. And it just hit me like an arrow right in the brain. I just said, man, that's it right there. It just, that's a thriller waiting to happen. And I mean, look, people ask me often, you know, what was the last thing you wrote before Spandau Phoenix? And I say, my college term paper, you know, literally over 10 years before my college term paper. That was the last thing I wrote. And then I sat down and wrote a novel 241,000 words long, you know.
Wow.
And man, you talk about an education, sort of a self-education. And, so many people I meet now, it shocks me. They say that's their favorite book. And I'm embarrassed about that book because I feel like, I was so poor at that point at developing character and all that. And think about the fundamental dictum of write what you know. You know, I knew a lot about World War II, but my God, I was writing about German characters and, you know, I was really stretching. Yeah. Now, I think with the second book, Black Cross, ironically, I think that's the best book I've ever written from the point of view of craft, from the point of view of story, intensity, all of it. And it's the only book I've ever written that wasn't a bestseller. I think it had to do with the paperback jacket. But anyway, the industry abounds with ironies. And when people ask me, I always say, you know, Black Cross is the best one, even though it's different from everything I've done since, you know?
Yeah. It's a really interesting discussion. Sometimes turns into argument between writers and about writing to market and writing, you know, serious literature that comes from the heart, and it can't be written to market because you know, these are serious books. There's something about you know, when you're focusing on this area and know that you're going to write a book that's going to appeal to this certain market, but still there was this moment where the story came alive to you. What do you say to people who say you can't write to market or you can't write books that are meant to sell and not still be a story that grabs people by the heart and you know, does its work?
Man, look, you're right in the sort of dilemma that I've lived in my whole career, which is if you're not going to write to market to some extent, you better find another job because you're going, right, to be doing another job most of your time, okay?
Yeah. Well, you need somebody to buy the stuff that you do.
Yes, you do. So I've made concessions to genre all the way through. There's no question about it, you know? And I'd be a lot richer today if I had just 100% made the concession, and the minute I had a best-selling novel in the Times, just do what, you know, a lot of bestsellers do and just start rewriting that book every time out. You know, I can at least say I've never done that. I've always followed what really interested me, and I think I've dealt with some pretty serious issues in my books. And so in that sense, I wasn't sitting down trying to write the great American novel or anything, and I absolutely was writing from the heart. But if you think I wasn't evaluating it based on the market, at least not like what is the best thing for the market, I don't ask myself that question. But I do ask myself, will this thing that has hold of my brain and my heart right now, will the market accept this on any level? Can I squeeze it into what people will accept? I mean, if you look at my Natchez Burning trilogy, which started as one book, wound up as three, took 10 years, was over 2,000 pages long, and dealt with race murder. I mean, how many strikes could I put against myself? I mean, really.
Yeah.
Even my first publisher, I lost my first publisher over that when I went to three books. I mean, they couldn't go with me on that journey, man. It was the scariest point in my life, you know, after my accident. And I just pushed on and said, well, the hell with it. I'm going to do it the way I want, and probably nobody's ever going to buy this. And it's just a miracle that it worked.
And I want to get back to that story in just a minute of Natchez Burning and how that blew up to what it is now. But for just a minute, you also have written books you've done your World War II thrillers, you've done some legal thrillers, and you've done some science fiction we were talking about before we started. What do you think about writers who are kind of all over the place with the things that they love, and does a writer have to stay in the genre that people expect them to?
Well, 95% of writers do have to, and all the pressure from the industry and publishers pushes you to that, and also the public. I think a lot of writers would like to break out of the box they're in. They don't have that luxury. And the only way you get to do it is by somehow finding a way to do one, and then if you manage to pull it off and keep selling books at the level of your other ones, because if you slip or slide or don't perform, they'll never let you do it again, you know?
Right.
So I think all writers are eclectic in their taste, but they get confined in this little box. And for me, you know, probably the most powerful moment of my life under 10 was when I saw my dad took me to see 2001 A Space Odyssey in 1968, you know. I heard George Clooney tell the same story, you know, and he and I are exactly the same age. And that thing was so powerful, it just like ripped my brain open, and it opened my mind to science fiction in a way that just, you know, and I'm not an aficionado now. I'm not up on current science fiction or anything like that. But, you know, when I was 13, 14, I read all that, Isaac Asimov and the classics and stuff. And I've always had the desire in me to, I have two outline science fiction novels, and one I think is the greatest concept I've ever come up with. But I know it can be a minefield. It gets right at what you're asking about what you are permitted to do, what you can do. I think George Clooney made the remake of Solaris, you know, I think was originally a Russian film.
Right.
I may be wrong about the origin, but I think Clooney did that because it was sort of his attempt to get close to a 2001 kind of story. And, you know, it wouldn't compare to his huge commercial films in terms of success, you know. Now George Clooney can afford to make a passion project then and now and then, and you know, can I afford to do that? I don't know. You know, and when I say can I afford, I don't mean it's a financial decision. It's a decision that has to do with, you know, you and your publisher and your public. You know, will they? It's like, you know, some metal band decides to make an acoustic album. You know, does their Dylan Goes Electric? You know, does the
right.
fan pay, does the fan base accept it? I don't know. You know.
Wow. Well, it's probably why a lot of writers write under pseudonyms or pen names when they branch out, just to give a little distance to that from their brand, so to speak.
Right, but think what a waste that is. You're going to throw away all the work you've done, everything you've built, to be John Smith? I mean, geez, that's hard.
Yeah. It is hard. It is hard. Well, maybe one day that will work itself out, but I look forward to seeing what you come up with the science fiction one day.
Thanks.
So, Greg, your trilogy, Natchez Burning, you mentioned that it was originally one book, and you wanted to extend it, and you know, there's all this stuff happened to you personally. You had a personal tragedy, a car wreck that was happening about this time, and then also, all the stuff happened with the fallout from this book. Can you tell us what happened and what made you want to extend the story?
Yeah. Okay. It initially started to be one book, and I was a foolish young man, I feel like now looking back, thinking that. Here was a story that was going to deal with my hometown, with real life civil rights murders, with race, with family, so many things. And as I started, I was just coming off a number one book in paperback, and I worked for a year, then over a year, I was late on my deadline, and I started to realize there was no way one book could contain the story. And that was disturbing to my publisher, who had paid me a lot of money and was waiting to get their, you know, get their book, you know. And I just dragged on and on, and look, I'm guilty of that. And I pulled out on Highway 61 one day, and truck hit my car door going 70 miles an hour, and I woke up out of a coma a week later, missing my leg with a torn aorta and many, many broken bones. And so my attitude just changed after that. I mean, when you come that close to dying, you stop caring about even the exigencies of business. You know, you just say, what is it I'm trying to do? And right. I realized that dealing with those themes and everything, I just had to let the chips fall. And so I did. And people, when I start to tell that story, people assume, I don't mean this in a negative way, but they assume it's like an Oprah story. You know, they could say, oh, you know, you followed your bliss and look how great it turned out. That is not what happened. It was like Jerry Maguire when he writes the note at his company. You know, the next thing I knew, I'd lost my publisher and I parted ways with my agent. I had no job and I owed all the money I'd been living on for the past 2 years back to my publisher, you know, and it was just the scariest part of my career. But it gave me the freedom to just say, you know what, the hell with it, man. I'm going to do what I need to do. And so I did. And fate just kind of saved me, you know. An editor who had edited me before at another publishing house came along and saved me by giving me a deal. And then the book just, you know, debuted at number two. It was just unbelievable. I think there was just a pent-up demand after many years. You know, conventional wisdom is that after a long time off the shelf, you're forgotten and you're nobody. But I think by being off the shelf 5 years, demand had built up, and that made people give it a chance, whereas otherwise they might have gone, what is this guy doing writing this huge book, you know?
right.
So, that was a long answer, but you get the idea.
Was it the same kind of feeling when you gave yourself that initial year to get something done?
But it was more desperate than that. Because, you know, you feel some desperation when you're 29 looking at 30 and all your friends are, you know, getting their first medical residency or you know, they're out in the world. They've had one or two kids and they're making a living. And you're like, what am I doing? You know,
right.
I'm playing in some college bar in wherever, you know. So, that's a certain kind of desperation, but that's nothing like having gotten to some semblance of the top of your profession and then almost be snatched into the grave and just realize. I mean, I really had doctors just tell me, say, you know, 99% of the people with your injury die within the first hour. You know?
Wow.
So once you've been there, you just say, well, all right, you know, that's not even intensity, man. It's just sort of like, it reminds me of, it's not like miraculous survival and you feel revitalized. It's more like what I've heard military stories say, where guys say in Vietnam or wherever, or World War I, they just sort of already considered themselves dead. And once they consider that, they just stop being scared, you know?
Right.
You just say, well, whatever happens is going to be whatever happens.
Yeah.
And that's the space you really need to be in when you're doing what you talked about. You know, we say write the book from the heart or these stereotypical things. What that really means is to write without fear.
Exactly.
And to do that is hard because we're all afraid of failure. We're all afraid of not selling the book. We're all afraid of, you know, terrible reviews of the public not getting what it is you're trying to do. And when you wake up one day and you just say, man, I couldn't care less about any of it, then that's the most liberating thing, to just say, by God, I'm going to take hold of these difficult subjects and I'm going to, like I said, referral, you know, just wrestle them into submission, kill them or they're going to kill me. you know?
Well, it's a great gift when you realize that your give a shit's busted.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That's right. Did you make that up or somebody else?
I don't know. I'll take credit now, and I'll put a note in the show notes if I figure out who said it better than me.
I mean, it really is. You're right.
Yeah. As a kid who grew up in East Central Mississippi and in the 70s and 80s, you know, we saw a lot of stuff, and we saw things that then get turned into movies and books, but we also see the world changing from our perspective. And then you realize the world doesn't change as much as you think. And, it's a real weird thing growing up in a place like we do. And when you start peeling back the layers and telling those stories, a lot of people wish that some of those stories would just go away. I grew up just down the road from Philadelphia, Mississippi, where where the civil rights murders happened. I knew some of the people, through family connections that went to prison for that. Our community was very closely connected to that. Lot of people wish that stuff would just go away. I've been working on a book for a couple of years now that deals with a similar situation like that. When you find yourself in the place where you just don't care anymore and you're going to tell the story that needs to be told, how do you start crafting this story that becomes Natchez Burning? And this is a huge story. It's more than just the surface story that gets, you know, dropped into bullet points. How do you start working out a story that's going to be that big?
Well, you know what? Thankfully, let me think for a second. The challenge is its own answer in a way. Okay. The challenge of dealing, think about what happened in Philadelphia. Your real dilemma at the start is, okay, these are real events that I'm taking off from. Why is it that I'm not writing a nonfiction book? What justifies a novel here to deal with this? Okay. Now, in what happened in Neshoba County, we were left after the events of history with a pretty accurate picture of what actually transpired.
Yeah.
Okay. Probably some things remained unknown, but we knew what happened. In the case of the Silver Dollar Group in Concordia Parish, which overall was much worse than the people over your way. Okay.
Yeah.
The FBI said it was the worst in the country. All right. So many had died. So much remained unknown. Victims' families even were dying. It was a situation where the truth could never really be known. The heroic reporter Stanley Nelson learned a lot and developed theories of the cases, and I think came very close in a lot of cases. But the real heart of it couldn't be known, and that created a natural space that almost demanded a fictional treatment. It was ideal for it and almost cried out for it, and it gets to the sort of Stephen King thing of fiction is the truth inside the lie, you know.
Right.
By creating a fictional version of that, I could go deeper into it than history ever was going to be able to, because so much was just lost. And so that gave me the limits sort of my story. It gave me the framework of it. And from there, then it was, and I actually came up with that, you know, before I decided to use Penn Cage for it. You know, Penn was lingering from the other books, and I thought, you know, he's ideally suited for that. He's right here. He's an attorney. He was an attorney. He's a novelist. He's dealt with history. He's my guy. You know, I mean, the template for that for me was, All the King's Men and
yeah.
Robert Penwarren dealing with Huey Long. I mean, I really think that I look at that. I mean, that's an old white guy's opinion, but I look at that as maybe the greatest American novel. You know, I mean, that thing, it's as relevant right this second as
yeah.
it was the day it was written.
Absolutely.
You know?
One of the things that I love about your novels is the way that you portray characters and the way that you fearlessly portray characters, all kinds of characters. And you're not afraid to let characters be nuanced and gray. And sometimes evil characters, in their mind, they have good motivations and they think they're doing the right thing. And sometimes people that may be martyred or, you know, become larger than life after the fact, they're still gray characters too. And even in the noble stance they take, they're regular humans. I think I heard you say one time that the difference between good and evil is the line right through the middle of the human heart. Can you talk a little bit about character building and being honest with people and letting them be who they are?
Yeah. It's, I mean, look, we all writers know, man, books are made by the antagonist, right? I mean, it's never the hero, you know, it's not Luke Skywalker that made Star Wars, it's Darth Vader and the hidden connections between, you know? So the dark characters, a lot, you know, I don't know how some writers miss this, but they do, but the villain is always the hero of his own story. You know, yeah. He thinks it's his novel and he's the hero, and you got to get that right. And then of course, as far as the fallibility of protagonists, I mean, all you have to do is just look at real life. I mean, if you peel away enough layers of anybody's life, you come to what, you know, used to be called sin or fallibility or whatever. And you gotta present that warts and all, and that's where humanity lies. I mean, any historical figure that's bigger than life, you know, it just inevitably, you regret it, you hate to see it, but eventually the hammer and the nails come out and they get crucified because the inner truth of their life comes out and they're just as human as anybody else. And you got to be fair like that as a writer. And I never get madder than when some reviewer says I have stock characters or something. I just go, man, you are full of it. The one thing I don't have is stock characters, you know?
yeah.
But, you know, I won't even go there.
After such a big series, so it's 2,000 pages, and you spent so much time with the story and these characters, the new book, Cemetery Road, you get away from Penn Cage. Was that a conscious effort to just wipe the slate clean? And if so, do you miss those characters in that story?
Well, I miss them, and I tell you, I will be going back. I've gotten thousands, really, of emails about that, and people did not like that, you know, Tom Cage ended up in prison there, and I think it served the story. Certainly, it's what needed to happen, but there's no way Tom's going to go out like that completely. That's all I'll say, okay? there's one more trip back to the world of Natchez Burning, and it was a relief to deal with Marshall in a new town. And also, you know, the primary difference, and I'll finish with this, the primary difference is Penn had a wonderful relationship with his father, just as I did with mine. I mean, Tom Cage in that trilogy was pretty much my dad in a lot of ways. Cemetery Road is very, very different in that the protagonist had a terrible relationship with his father, even no relationship after 18, and to have to come back home because he's dying and navigate that rocky terrain I've never written a story like that. And so it was new for me, but I think it's good, and hopefully people will find that's a welcome change too. You know?
So the new novel, which is coming out tomorrow when people are hearing this, is called Cemetery Road. From the Natchez Burning trilogy, where do you bring us to in this book?
Well, this book. This book is in a small Mississippi town. It's a fictional town, unlike, you know, I spent 10 years writing in the town of my youth and a real place across the river in Louisiana, Concordia Parish. And, man, you know, that's a tough thing to do. That's a minefield in a lot of ways. And so in this book, I gave myself the luxury of a fictional town nearby my hometown in the fictional universe. And it's about a guy going through what a lot of people my age are, you know, he left his town when he was young, was in a great circumstance, and he meant never to come back. And now that he's at the peak of his success in Washington, D.C., his father is ill, terminally ill, and he's forced to drop everything and go back home to deal with it. And I know so many people going through that, you know, people in their 50s, their late 40s, whatever, they're having to drop everything to deal with a parent who can't take care of themselves, and that's kind of repaying the debt of childhood. And when he comes back and has to run the family newspaper, that's what throws him into conflict with the forces in the town that represent, what would you say as a writer, you know, the shadow, the sort of Jungian shadow. And You know, it's about something else I think is true all over America. A lot of these towns that were vibrant and thriving in the 60s are just shells of themselves. They've reached a tipping point. The people are desperate, whether it's here or it's the Rust Belt. And it's how far will people go when economic salvation is offered, in this case, in the form of a Chinese paper mill. But it doesn't just have to be a small town. Look at Amazon going to New York, you know. People, right. People get crazy when they think they can see millions of dollars, you know. But ultimately what it's about, like all my books, it's about the secrets that really drive human life, you know, the things people keep from each other, husbands and wives, parents and children, siblings, and we tend to judge the surface of life, and we're puzzled all the time. You know, why is this person being this way? Why is this happening in my town? It's you're not seeing the true landscape. You know, the emotional and factual landscape is not the thing you see. It's the things that people hide. And I right. think that's a theme that runs through all my work.
Well, in the South, and in Mississippi particularly, specifically, we have certain issues that other parts of the country, you know, maybe don't deal with in a public way the way we have in our past. Do you ever get pushback from people for portraying the honest truth about the way the world is?
Sure, I do. Especially when you start dealing with things like the Klan or the Confederacy or tradition, what are called traditions in Mississippi, et cetera, there's going to be pushback. I mean, we're living through some pretty profound changes culturally right now, and it's happening, I think, at a faster and faster pace, you know. And people, there are always people who are going to resist, and so people like me become a focal point for their, you know, their anger. That's just the way it is. But, you know, Natchez has been great about me setting novels there that are, you know, one reviewer said Greg Isles does Natchez, Mississippi, the backhanded compliment of setting his novels there. And I think that's right. I mean, it looks pretty rough and not flattering, but yet, you know what? It's brought a lot of tourists there, and people have been real good about it, you know?
Yeah. Well, Greg, I'm a huge fan. The new book Cemetery Road is out everywhere now. We're going to send everybody to pick up a copy of it. If people are just discovering you and your work, is there a place where they can read more about you online, maybe dig into your back catalog and all that good stuff?
But just go to gregisles.com, and I don't know what better advice to give them. But look, the best thing they can do is just pick up a book and be aware that when you read me, any book that you pick up could be profoundly different from every other one. That's what that's what's different about me from most writers, except maybe Michael Crichton, who, you know, he did some pretty different stuff all over the map, you know. So I hope people will do that, and, you know, they'll either like it or they won't, but I trust that they will.
Well, and just like a Michael Crichton book, you can always tell that it's a Crichton story, no matter where it is, and you can always tell that this is a Greg Isles book. It sounds like you. So we're going to put links to everything in the show notes. Greg, it's been a huge pleasure getting to talk with you. Much success on the new book launch.
Thanks, Hank, and good luck with your books, man. Look forward to it. See you.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
The brutes of the Andersonville Prison Hospital have moved me to the dead room, or so it has come to be known. None so domiciled have yet left this place. We receive only the smallest rations and only cursory care, to reduce our odors and spare the nostrils of our keepers. The good Christians of the Confederacy do not see any need to provide comfort to those who will soon sleep soundly enough underground. You must know, at least, how your father came to such an end. At Doctortown, Kilpatrick entrusted me with the conquest of a railroad trestle, and my bummers, my demolition team, acquitted themselves admirably, thanks to my ingenuity with powder. We successfully destroyed the trestle work past Morgan's Lake. This would prove to be my entire contribution to the war. Federal troops were unable to capture the bridge or overcome the enemy's battery. Kilpatrick withdrew, and my bombers and I found ourselves on the wrong side of the Altamaha River, behind the enemy line, with no hope of reaching our encampment. Rebels accosted us, taking our remaining supplies. We escaped and headed south, hoping by a long march to reach Seymour's forces in Jacksonville, but we encountered other rebel encampments at Jessup. 4 of my men were lost to gunfire. We marched west, then south again, barely evading capture. We had no choice but to brave the great swamp Okefenokee. Oh, on and on it goes, in every direction, endlessly. We trudged through miles of grasping mud and noxious rot, pursued by hunger and the mosquito, scratching at our arms and faces until all our skin was scourged. We lived off alligator meat at first, then nothing at all. My men grew mutinous, blamed me for all their misfortunes, threatened to throw me in a sack, weigh me down with stones, and sink my body. Yet was I not equally hungry? Did I not starve? I grew weary of their endless insubordination and contempt. Finally, they took hold of me and swore they would hang me by the neck for leading them to ruin. They were 5 in number, younger than I and more muscular. I was no match for them physically. They laid their hands on me and I burned them. I burned those men. The flame rose from me as from a volcano, stripping the skin from those boys, blackening their faces, roasting their flesh. And let this be my final ghastly confession. I feasted that night, feasted on the meat of my prospective murderers. And that is how I survived. I staggered alone from that swamp, a mad thing, fueled by outrage and guilt. I saw an encampment of rebel soldiers and surrendered myself gladly. They say in Andersonville prison all men are brothers, equal in filth, equal in terror, equal in ruin. Yet I feel I may claim some small distinction, at least, for I am surely damned to a greater extent than any here.